How are y'all doing? Yeah? I appreciate everyone who is here. And my name's Faye. I'm one of the folks helping organize today, and I use she and they pronouns. And this is Julie.
I'm Julie. I'm really thrilled for you to be here, and I use she and her pronouns.
Awesome. Before we kick it off, I do want to again thank everybody for being here. This is an event that has taken us a few months to organize, and we really appreciate the fact that folks have come from Toronto, from Ottawa, from all over the country to share space with us and learn about being better to trans folks and trans youth. So give yourselves a round of applause. Just some stuff to be mindful for throughout today is first and foremost, please be respectful of folks' pronouns. Make sure that you don't make assumptions based off how people look, all of that jazz, just to make sure we're doing the best that we can to respect everybody who's sharing space with us today. Does that make sense? Awesome. I love when people clap at pronouns. So thank you to those people. As well, just be mindful of consent in terms of like any hugs, high fives, handshakes, any of those things. Make sure you ask folks before you do anything to and with their body, just so that we make sure we're respecting everybody's needs, and like bodily autonomy is like a really nice thing to have happen. Does that also make sense? Awesome. Y'all are like a really clappy group, and I love it. In general today, we are trying to like have it be a very laid back event, but throughout the day, if you need to step out, like do what you need to do. You know your bodies better than we ever could. If you need to like lie down in the middle of the room somewhere, that is also totally fine. I usually run like hippie events where we sit in a circle and we have like mats and we lie down on them, and it's just really fun. So do what you need to do to keep yourself as well as you can. Does that also make sense? Awesome. Thank you. So our starting is, we have our trans youth panel who will be joining us in a couple minutes up here. And that's really just about centering the space from the get-go, to be intentional about centering the voices of trans young folks themselves, as we've tried to do throughout this event, and particularly trans young folks who are less likely to be heard in spaces like this. So racialized, black, indigenous, trans folks, folks from rural communities, from northern communities. And so we're trying to be intentional with that throughout the day. And so I keep that in mind as well as we share space together. Does that also make sense? Awesome. Before we get too into the agenda, we did want to ground some folks in definitions and terminology around how we're sharing space here. I want to caveat that by saying that we all define our experiences and the lives that we live in different ways using different terminology, and there is no like standardized best practice for how to like talk about trans and gender diverse people, but I'm going to try to give some standardized practices around how to talk about trans and gender diverse people anyways. I say that because we just want to be mindful that, yes, definitions are good and meaningful and powerful, but we also live in a world that is really complicated, diverse, and we need to like give space for that as well. So, definitions I'm going to give y'all are for trans, gender diverse, non-binary, cis, colonialism, and white supremacy. Trans, if folks don't know, means that the gender you were assigned at birth is different from the gender with which you identify. So if you're born and the doctor's like, oh, you have these bits, so you must be this gender, and in some way, shape, or form, you grow up and you don't identify with that gender, you fall under the broad trans umbrella. On the other hand, cis is when you're born and the doctor's like, you have these bits, so you must be this gender. And if you grow up and you're like, wow, yeah, that works for me, I can be that thing, that falls under the cis umbrella. In terms of gender diverse is kind of like a broad descriptor of gender experience that don't fall into our easy categories of like binary male and female. It's a broad term that's supposed to capture a lot more of the diversity that we know exists when we think about gender. It usually includes like gender diverse or like non-binary folks, genderqueer folks, agender folks, as well as trans folks, two-spirit folks, folks of all kinds of different gender identities. The other two definitions, so again, throughout this event, we tried to do our best, imperfectly, but as best as we can, to center indigenous, black, and racialized trans young folks. And so white supremacy is a key definition to keep that in mind and to keep in mind throughout today as we share space together. And our definition for white supremacy is that white supremacy is an ongoing process where whiteness and white people are privileged and centered in all spaces and institutions, federally, locally, in every way, shape, and form. And that happens to the detriment of indigenous, racialized, and black folks in this land. And it manifests itself in a terrifying diversity of ways that we are still in the midst of like unpacking and addressing. And that happens both systemically, also locally, and also in our interpersonal relationships as well. So not just in this like abstract way, but also in terms of how we engage with each other as friends, colleagues, folks who share space together, and white supremacy is always manifest in those spaces. And the last one is colonialism. Colonialism is a systemic process in which land is is taken and culture is intentionally removed, and where whiteness and white supremacy is in put into place. And so it's that ongoing process where land is seized, where folks are indoctrinated into a particular way of existing on this land. That is, like white supremacy, an ongoing systemic process that happens locally, provincially, nationally, and as well as in our interpersonal relationships. Does that make sense? Awesome. I think that's all that I have on my little to-do list, so I'm going to turn it over to Julie. But thanks, y'all.
I just wanted to say a few things. So I'm Julie, and I have to say, I wanted to promise myself I was going to take a moment to really appreciate you, to breathe in the space and just look at the beautiful faces in front of me who've engaged today to come support young people in ways that they lead. And so I'm so grateful that you're here. I wanted to welcome you. So I want to welcome the guests in front of me. Thank you for traveling. You know, if you're in Toronto, traveling from Toronto, rearranging your schedules. Thank you for coming from BC. Thanks for coming from Newfoundland, from out west, from Peterborough, from Ottawa. I am very, very grateful for your presence. We have beautiful attendees in the house tonight, in our space, that come from across all sectors. So I hope there's some beautiful conversations and relationships that are going to form in this space. So thank you for being here. So I also wanted to thank our international folks. I wanted to thank Diane for coming in from the U.S. I wanted to thank Linda for coming in the U.S., from Joel from the U.S., from Simon from South Africa, and I wanted to thank, most of all, the youth that have organized this event. So when I started having conversations with young people, and this is when I got my job 3 years ago, I organized young people and just said, what do you need? And they were very clear about that. So they said three things, and these were all young trans people. They said, one, we're tired of having events about us without us. Two, we are leading in education already, but usually our work is volunteer and not paid, so we need to have our labor paid and honored. And three, they insisted that Indigenous, racialized, and disabled voices are centered in that process. And so for me, those folks can run the world, right? And I'll do my best to follow while I'm here. And so that's the orientation that I hope that all of us express today, especially as our young people get up on stage and get into our workshops and share with you their truth, that you take off your expert caps and you move into a space of reflection and absorption and active listening. And if something comes up for you internally about what they're saying, maybe take that with you and reflect on it and understand what that might mean for you. So in that, I wanted to offer a critical land acknowledgement. And I have to say, I've never found that land acknowledgements do the justice that needs to happen. And I've never found the words personally to express as a white settler on this space what it actually means and the violence that it actually continues to happen. There is one person, and there's a colleague of mine, Syra, who's in the audience, who expressed the words of Tara Farhani, who's another staff member at Ryerson, and it started to touch on some of the sentiments that I think that need to be shared. So I'm going to start with that, then I'm going to give the standard land acknowledgement, and then I'm going to give the space to the youth, back to the youth. So as settlers here in Canada, some by choice and others not, it is important that we recognize and remember that this land, its resources, its history were stolen from its Indigenous people. It is important for us to acknowledge that our opportunity to come here today to write, to share space with one another as a result of a long legacy of colonialism. Colonialism which continues to impact the lives of many Indigenous peoples and communities across Canada today. Colonialism that we as settlers continue to benefit from. Land acknowledgements can be uncomfortable and unsettling as they encourage us to reflect and be critical of our Canadian history. But land acknowledgements alone are merely an invitation to acknowledge ourselves in relation to this history, an invitation to acknowledge how we perpetuate this history, and an invitation to acknowledge how we can contribute to changing history. And so, with this land acknowledgement, I encourage and remind myself and everyone here today, especially those who are non-Indigenous, to reflect and honor the truths and the past of the land on which we sit, to lean into the discomforts as they arise when they do, and work actively with this discomfort to seek new learnings and unlearnings about the land that we collectively call home. So the following statement is Ryerson's land acknowledgement. Toronto is the dish with one spoon territory, The dish with one spoon is a treaty between the Anishinaabe, Mississaugas, and Haudenosaunee that bound them to share the territory and protect the land. Subsequent indigenous nations and peoples, Europeans, and all newcomers have been invited into this treaty in the spirit of peace, friendship, and respect. So with that, I invite the youth panelists to come up.
Hello. So my name is Finn, and I am the moderator for this panel, and I go by they, them. We're going to start by introducing ourselves, and then we're going to talk a little bit about our different work practices, community engagements, and lived experiences. We can maybe go in a row. Do you want to do that?
Sure.
Yeah.
So, hi, everyone. My name is Keegan Prempe, and I use Z-Zer pronouns, and I spell it with an X-E. So, in a sentence, it might sound like Z is sitting on this panel about trans youth experiences. And so I'm really, really honored to be here today and to chat with you folks. To tell you a little bit about myself, I am a first-generation immigrant here. My parents grew up in Ghana in West Africa, and so that's where I'm from. I identify as like a community organizer, as somebody who, you know, cares very deeply about, you know, their roots and who they are and where they come from and how to share space with people who look like me and then also those who don't. And so in the past, I've worked with different grassroots community organizations. So one example of that is Trans Health Information Ottawa, which has existed in Ottawa. And so I was a collective member with that organization. I'm a social worker by profession, but certainly I'm really, really passionate about this type of work and, you know, kind of existing outside of institutions. And I'm also somebody who deals with, you know, a variety of health conditions, you know, and wants to really, you know, emphasize the fact that there are many parts of me that I think really make myself suited for this type of work. And to, you know, to be here today with you folks and to share my gifts is really special to me. And I, you know, really want to make sure I'm doing right by my ancestors and right by my family and the people who love me and support me by being here today and sharing my knowledge with you. And so I should talk a little bit about, you know, the frameworks that I use in terms of, you know, the work that I do. And so I'm a proponent of womanism, you know, which is a specific black type of feminism, a black woman type of feminism. And for me, that's been really important in grounding my experiences as somebody who moves through the world and who can be interpreted as a black woman sometimes, not all the time, sometimes. Sometimes things change. And that's cool. And so for me, you know, thinking about Kimberly Crenshaw's understanding of intersectionality and this idea that, you know, the social locations that we occupy, our race, our genders, our sexualities, these things influence the way that we move through the world and are impacted by institutions. And I think it's really important that as we, you know, we're sitting here today thinking about, you know, how can we improve access to care or access to, you know, supportive spaces for trans and gender diverse youth. And so I think, you know, as we've kind of mentioned already briefly, you know, there are all different types of trans people, all different types of identities that we hold simultaneously. And so intersectionality and womanism for me have been really integral in grounding my understanding of myself and how I relate to the world. And also, I think it helped me realize that, you know, these, you know, experiences that I've had where I felt, you know, less than human, where people haven't respected my various identities, you know, is not a me problem. It's like a systemic problem, that this isn't, I'm not the issue here, you know. And even though definitely it feels that way sometimes, or it feels like I'm, you know, maybe I'm asking too much of people, or maybe, you know, I'm expecting too much to want people to use my pronouns and to not say racist things to me. And like, no, that's not, like, what? That's ridiculous. And so those have been really useful tools for me. And so I hope today I'm able to, yeah, really demonstrate, you know, kind of my understanding of how I live my life and how what it's like for me and my community members to exist and move through the world. So hello and thank you.
Hi, I am Alex Rivers. I'm 22. I use they, them pronouns. I used to do LGBTQ involvement in my high school and college. I've lived various levels of humanhood, I guess, because I've been through a lot of marginalized experiences. For me, I've been a part of the homeless community. I've been a part of the low-income community. I've been a part of many, many communities at this point. I am a person of color. I'm trans. I have ties to the LGBTQ community. I am also disabled. Mental health-wise, I've been working on it for about 5 years. My lovely friends do a lot more community work than I, as I'm working on my health and trying to get as better as possible to, you know, go back and kind of help others when I can. And through using the systems for so long, I've learned a lot about how I have to move myself in the world. So I'm, I guess, a service user, I guess you could say.
Hi, my name's Caden. I'm Caden Seaburn. I use they, them pronouns, or he, him pronouns are also good as well. White settler from Ottawa, Ontario, and unceded Algonquin Territory. And I'm a Bachelor of Social Work student at Carleton University, and I do a lot of community organizing and advocacy and education work around there, and sometimes in other places as well. And one of the big projects that I'm working on right now is that I'm a facilitator for a bi and four community youth group in Ottawa. And that's really exciting to me because one of the things that's really important to me in the work that I do is thinking about and talking about and working around trans and gender diverse identities in ways that are not pathologizing and that move out of like medical systems and social service systems and institutions. And I think that having those kinds of services can be really important in some cases, but sometimes it feels like the only way that we ever talk about trans identities or experiences is in the context of like doctors' offices and institutions and medical services. And to me, that's not really what being trans is at all. For me, in the work that I do, it's really important to create spaces and conversations that are outside of that space and that are just within community, hanging out in parks or hanging out with your friends or building community in ways that are not within those systems. And also like having conversations within the community and understanding that transgender diverse youth and transgender diverse communities in general are really the experts in our experiences and our care, and that in order for health and social service systems to serve us in a way that is helpful, that transgender diverse young people really need to be the people who are leading that and who are being actively engaged in ways that are really meaningful and not just kind of like tokenizing or like checking a box, but to like really recognize the like amazing expertise and knowledge and experience that every single young transgender diverse person that I've worked with has.
Hello, I am Kieran B. Drakenberg. I use he, him pronouns, and I go by Kier for short. I'm 19 years old, and I come from Iqaluit, Nunavut, which is, if you don't know, the capital of Nunavut and kind of far up north. I identify as a youth advocate, and I do a lot of work with the mental health community and the LGBTQ community. I've been involved in activism probably since I was about 8 years old when I organized my first fundraiser. I really got involved with the mental health community when I was about 10 or so, when I experienced my first bout of being suicidal. I am Indigenous, I am Métis. I come from an under-resourced community. I do have some privilege, though. I come from a well-off family, and I am physically abled. I received my first publication when I was 13 years old, an article talking about mental health. I came out when I was about 14 or 15, and I was like the first openly trans person in my high school. A lot of people came out after me and looked to me for help and support, which was a lot to take on at that age, but I wanted to be there for people. Since then, I've done a lot of work with like Kids Help Phone. I've been working for them, well, not working for them, volunteering for them since I was 10. And I do a lot of fundraising for them. I now sit on their Indigenous Advisory Council, which just began last year. I also was selected to be this year's youth co-convener for the International Association of Youth Mental Health's biannual international conference that takes place in Brisbane, Australia this year. So I'm organizing that at the moment. I'm really excited for this. To talk a little bit about my framework, I come from the idea that experience is key. Experienced voices are key, but not necessarily. People who have experience in the lived situations should be the centered voices. So to give the example, like me, someone, an Indigenous person probably knows best about Indigenous things. I've also done consultations with the government before talking about gender diverse experiences with like Randy Boisinot, the special advisor to the Prime Minister on LGBTQ issues, and just general consultations where I've sat in a room with like 20 other people and discussed what we want to see as changes in Canada. That's a brief overview of my work. So yeah, thank you very much. I hope everyone has a really good day today.
Cool. Wow, can we get a hand for Kier?
Thank you very much. That means a lot to me.
I'm Pri. I did my undergrad in communication studies at York. I did my master's in the communication and culture program at Ryerson in York. I moved out to Montreal. I taught for a few years. I finally accepted that teaching just doesn't pay well. moved into, I guess, the workforce. I now work for a tech company in Toronto. I like to describe myself as a trans Batman. I work 8 to 5 in the tech startup industry. And then I do art, facilitation, community organizing. I prefer to teach within the community as opposed to academia for now anyways, and that could change. I am one of the co-founders of the Non-Binary Color Collective, which operates here in Toronto. We held the first ever 2SQT BIPOC arts fair a few weeks ago, and it was completely community run, completely volunteer run and organized, and was a really wonderful event where a number of racialized and indigenous and black youth were able to take home 100% of their profits, and I'm hoping to do more work like that. I'm a cancer survivor, I am chronically ill, and that's something that I live with every day, and it informs a lot of my work. The frameworks that I generally work from are an anti-oppressive framework, and the big thing within that being knowledge and learning is an ongoing process. Going back to what Julie said a little bit earlier and what Faye was saying a little bit earlier, it's important to remember that we can always learn, and we can always grow, and we can always be wrong. And I'm hoping that that's something that we can remember here today with the amazing panels and workshops that we have today. And going back to what Keegan was saying earlier, a lot of my work is informed by Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term intersectionality. It's important to remember that as non-black individuals, we cannot call ourselves intersectional feminists because that's something that was created by and for black women and those particular intersections of violence that they face. However, I do like to practice and reference intersectionality in my work as a non-black person of color. I do want to self-identify as a settler on Turtle Island. My parents moved from Punjab, which is a state in India that faces a lot of genocide. It is a state that, you know, hopes to one day be separate from the state itself. My parents kind of never made it out of poverty, and so I'm really grateful to be here today, really grateful for the privilege of having higher education and being able to speak from my racialized, trans, and non-binary perspective. My pronouns are they, them. Please not misgender me. I'm gonna be really angry. This is the space to not misgender me. I am kind of interested to engage in this conversation in this space, but also online. So if you end up tweeting anything, tag me at Prezilla, and I'm excited to be here today. So thank you.
Cool.
Yeah. Yay.
Some of the questions, not everyone's gonna be able to speak to, but I will kind of keep the questions open enough. So to go back to intersectionality, I think we all kind of touched a little bit on it, and I want to know if any of you would like to share more about your opinions in terms of how services are transforming or what needs to be revised or what needs to be more informed. And also, I guess, with intersectionality, sometimes I think as young people, it can be difficult to find supports in different groups within our communities. What are your thoughts? What are your experiences? And what do you advise?
Can I go first?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. I come from Iqaluit Inuvik, as I previously stated. It's a very under-resourced area in terms of healthcare. In my experience, when I came out, there was no gender specialist, there's no endocrinologist, there's no people who can help you in the transition process. Doctors are very undereducated in terms of transgender and gender diverse people. And a lot of the time they have competency in indigenous needs and or trans needs and not really both. There's a lot of like struggle when it comes to intersectionality. Like a lot of the time there's an element of you're not enough of something. Like you have to prove that you're trans enough, you have to prove that you're disabled enough, you have to prove that you're enough of anything. There's a lot of that. The way that it works in Iqaluit is that when I came out, I was referred to a gender specialist in Ottawa. I had to fly down. It was paid for by the government because it was healthcare. But things like receiving healthcare, you have to fly to Ottawa for a lot of specialist appointments. It's especially daunting in trans needs where you need that continuous care. Along with that, when it comes to things like mental health, our care is very non-continuous. There is not a large LGBTQ community in Iqaluit, so there's not a lot of support. We don't have support groups. We do have some adult mentors, but there isn't a lot of like outwardly trans people. And so when it comes to things like intersectionality in like service providers, even some people are not totally trained in like competency towards like black people or Asian people or any thing that is not white. There's definitely a huge gap in the doctor's ability to deal with trans people. I've had a lot of bad experiences with healthcare providers, things having to prove that I'm trans enough. When I came down to Ottawa once for a trans support group, I was told directly by the other youth there that if I wanted to receive treatment, I had to lie to the doctor. I was told, do not tell them you're non-binary if you're non-binary because you will not receive treatment. Do not tell them that you're questioning your gender. Do not tell them you don't have dysphoria. Don't tell them anything like that because they will deny you treatment. There was a huge barrier of that dishonesty between me and the doctor because otherwise I would not receive the treatment that I desired and needed. As an Indigenous youth, there's definitely a lack of competency in the area of ability to deal with Indigenous people. I think I'll kind of pause there and let anyone else speak.
I'd like to go. I think a lot of the struggles that a lot of transgender-verse youth face when trying to access care or like support in the different kind of institutions that they exist in, I think a lot about how historically trans people have been viewed within those types of institutions, and this idea that, you know, transness was something that needed to be fixed, or, you know, something that was wrong with you, like, you know, for some reason you thought you were a boy when you really were a girl, or you thought you were a girl when you really were a boy. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's based on this, you know, really gender essentialist idea that, you know, men are like this because they have these body parts, and so they're going to have like these traits and like really like football and like eating meat and like things like, and you know, girls are going to like wearing dresses and like playing with dolls and baking things and are like natural caregivers. And so these like, you know, really kind of strict gender roles, I think, are typically reflected in a lot of healthcare settings. I think it's also reflected in schools and other social services. And so as a trans person, you disrupt what a lot of practitioners have always thought of as truth, has always thought of as, well, this is the way it is because this is what I was told. And so nothing else can exist because this is what I've always known it to be. And so I think that's where a lot of us have to, you know, really prove our transness because we exhibit behavior that isn't easily confined to one box or the other, perhaps, or we associate with one box and not the other. And so I think it'll be really critical for those of us who are interested in transforming our institutions to really take a look at, you know, what have I been taught about gender, and how do I apply that in my life? Because we all, like, have a gender. We've all been told lots of things, like, all across our lifetime about what gender means and how to exhibit gender properly or improperly. I think, you know, a lot of the spaces that transgender-diverse people access are very binary in nature, are very gender essentialist or biological essentialist in nature, and so it keeps us from being our authentic selves because our authentic selves just aren't reflected in the literature. It's not reflected in traditional practices. It's not, you know, something that is taught in schools necessarily, or I would argue at least not in a way that is actually reflective of trans people's experiences. And so I think for change to really happen, we have to really, really shake up how we think about gender and what we know as fact about gender and what's like just biology and like, you know, other things that people say that really limit gender expression.
Can I ask you to repeat the question, please?
Yeah, sure. It was basically asking about how you have navigated or found supports within different environments you've been in. So this can be like services, or this can be friends, or this can be mentors or mentees.
For myself, I would say through community members. Having lived in Toronto, Montreal, Halifax, and a little bit, I think the main source of information has been community members, friends, chosen family, things like that. Something that I forgot to say in my introduction, which is kind of important and relevant to today, I worked on the research project that is producing the report that's going to be available to the public with recommendations to the government with MHCC and Ryerson and with Julie James. I was the researcher that was kind of hired to mine the data. I'll be talking about some of the findings later this afternoon, but I have some jot notes of things from the community consultations that I did. So I think maybe I'll take the opportunity to talk about some of those findings today. I think earlier you mentioned something along the lines of intersectionality and community resources or challenges.
Yeah.
As well?
Yeah. Like, speaking from my own experience, I think that there have been times, especially when I was like younger, it was hard to find not only like queer or trans people, but like people that could relate on a level that was relevant to like my experiences as an Asian, like Asian child. Youth group, sometimes in smaller towns, it can be hard for a person of color to go into different levels of understanding, right? So I think that the question is how, in our experiences, have we found we're able to either create or find these spaces that make us comfortable, you know, like relevantly. Do you know what that makes sense?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Thank you. First and foremost, they're really rare. They're really hard to find. I think mostly what I'll be doing in the panel today is kind of speaking from the findings, from the community consultations and that data, unless I self-reference exactly. So with the community consultations, I spoke to Black, Indigenous, and people of color, youth that either identify as trans, gender non-conforming, non-binary, agender. Oftentimes we use non-binary or agender as the umbrella term. For some folks, that's not the case. The distinctions are really important to them. So I just kind of want to put that out there, that not everybody identifies with all of those terms. For some, it's only one. But some of the things that were brought up repeatedly were the fact that doctors expected individuals to kind of figure it out on their own. So if somebody went in and asked for HRT or said, you know, finally came out and said, look, I'm trans, what can I do? Or I think I might want surgery, or I think I might want XYZ, what do I do? The doctors were kind of just like, I don't know, you figure it out. I gotta Google it, come back and see me in 3 months. that's actually like what they were told. In other cases, BIPOC folks were told, you know, that they have to wait 6 to 12 months. One of the things that was recurring was for non-white trans people, we come into our transness a lot later in life, which means that those youth experiences of coming out when you're 12, you know those kids that you see on like Ellen and Tyra and like City Line, they're usually white, okay? So it takes us a while to deal with the internalized transphobia and homophobia within our communities and come to terms with who we are in most cases. And what that means is, like, for example, one of the subjects that I spoke with who is trans, non-binary, looking to go on HRT as a non-binary person, something that they're facing is every time they go into a doctor, ask for help, they're kind of pushing top surgery, full-blown T, full-blown everything, but they're like, look, I'm non-binary. I'm looking for this specific kind of treatment, and they're being told, no, there's male-to-female and female-to-male and nothing in between. So healthcare providers really need to be explained that there is a spectrum that we know our bodies best, as my colleagues have mentioned. There are more than 2 ways, more than 3 ways, more than 70 ways to be trans, and the issue is that the folks that are supposed to be in charge of helping us don't know how to help us, don't know how to listen to us, and don't have the proper training and resources to help us. And what that also means is a lot of the resources that are available to youth, so youth can be defined as a number of different ways, but for a lot of resources that are available in Toronto, those resources end at 25. So one of those subjects that I spoke with is 28, 29, and so they've been fundraising to be able to access HRT for the last year, and still don't have enough money, and they can't access the therapy that they need, the drugs that they need in order to be affirmed in their gender because they're not, you know, youth enough. And so what do we do when BIPOC youth are experiencing their transness at a much later age and they can't access these youth resources? So that's one of the recurring issues that I want to reference from the community consultations that I did as a part of the survey research.
Can I speak again?
Yeah.
what you were saying, Finn, about intersectionality, I just want to touch on answering the question again. In my experience, accessing resources has mainly been the internet. Oh, yay, the internet. It, like, solves all your problems, yay. Not really. No, I'm lying. But internet was a huge resource for me, and it was a huge resource for, like, my mother did a lot of research when I came out because she wanted to support me. It was a lot of her finding online support groups, online things, because unfortunately, we also don't have really good internet in Iqaluit, so it's very slow, and unfortunately, that means that even online stuff isn't really good enough, and it's not good enough in general, but it's something. In my case, it was, I told a doctor, hey, I think I'm trans, and they were like, okay, I'm going to send you to Ottawa. So that was definitely the experience for me, and the experience for my trans friends was just, I'm sorry, I can't deal with it, I'm not trained for it, so bye. I have experienced a lot of like racism in my life, and that goes in like tandem with my being trans. And I wanna speak to the fact that racism is still very much alive right now. Actually, I think 2 days ago, I was walking down the street over on Dundas and Young, and a man came up to me and said, "You effing Indian," to my face. So it's 2019, and this is still very much happening, and I want us to all be aware of the fact that racism against any race is still very much happening right now. For trans people of color, those experiences create a unique experience. I was raised in a mostly white cultural background, despite being Métis. So that's why I think I was able to come out a lot younger than my Indigenous peers. And it's definitely very difficult to come out in a very rural community because everybody knows everyone. So you don't get that experience of saying to a close friend or to someone random, "I think I'm trans," because if you say that, everybody will know in 2 days. When I came out as trans, that was the talk of the town for a while. I thought that because I lived in a small town, there would not be a lot of support, but I was blessed in the experience that a lot of people just didn't really care, to be frank. They were kind of like, "You do you. You do whatever you want." So, and then my friends are all very supportive. Their parents, in some cases, not so much, but my friends are supportive, so I've been blessed. So, but it's not the case for a lot of Indigenous youth, especially in farther north communities, where they're even smaller, because Iqaluit is 7,000 people and the biggest community in Nunavut. So in a lot of smaller communities where there's even less good internet, less good connections, less doctors, it's much harder to come out, and I'm very aware of that.
Can I quickly add something before we move forward?
Yeah.
First of all, your mom sounds really cute. Second of all, despite all the atrocious things that you faced and you're continuing to face, I'm really glad that you had a pleasant experience in terms of the support from your mom. I've had a mixed experience in my own experience of coming out. First coming out as queer, then coming out as trans, then explaining to my mom what non-binary means. There's no term in Punjabi for non-binary. It's challenging to explain that within a cultural context. And something I wanted to say is, it's important from the folks that I had spoken to that there needs to be this understanding that BIPOC trans experiences can be really different. So some individuals expressed, you know, the worst of the worst. Other individuals expressed that their families were really supportive. But when they went in to speak to a case manager, they were like, "You're from XYZ country. Damn, your parents must be super homophobic or super transphobic." And they're like, "My parents love me a lot. Can I just get the support that I'm actually looking for?" So making sure that those assumptions aren't made about racialized and BIPOC folks, even within that, understanding the needs of newcomer or refugee trans youth are significantly different than those that are socialized and raised within English speaking countries or countries that have a similar culture. So we have a really strong understanding of the binary here, the pink, blue, the dolls, the people who, you know, men eating meat that Keegan was talking about. But for example, in the Philippines, there is no such thing as the binary, and the language isn't gendered in the same way that French or Spanish might be, for example. And so what that means is that Filipinx newcomer youth situations are very different, and they need different kinds of support and needs because, to begin with, they have no exposure to the way that the binary works here. So those expectations of how boys are supposed to act, or how cis folks are supposed to act, or how trans folks are expected to act is just a completely new phenomenon, and they need really different support as opposed to newcomers from somewhere else. If it's okay for me to add, from the Indigenous folks that I spoke with, they echoed that it's really important to not clump Indigenous youth together. So the needs of First Nations youth are significantly different than Inuit youth, or, you know, the needs of folks that might be Anishinaabe or Ojibwe. And within that, for some Indigenous folks, they may identify with being Two-Spirit. Others don't. Some identify with being Indigiqueer and Two-Spirit, but others don't. And so it's really necessary for this entire spectrum of differences to be available in terms of the resources, and for us to not have monoliths used to clump us together. As you can see, we're all very different just looking on the outside, but from, you know, our actual experiences, the services, the supports that we need are also very different. And I just wanted to add that, you know, as an Indigenous person, you talking about your experience with your mom being super supportive, I feel like that changes the kinds of supports that you then need in terms of health services, as opposed to some of the other folks that I've spoken to, and like the Filipinx person that I spoke to, for example. So I just wanted to add that before moving forward.
Mm-hmm. I think we will slowly wrap things up. We'll do like a bit of a closing. So given that, like, of course, we're all very different. We have
different backgrounds and stuff, I want to talk about visibility and how that also varies and how people hold different opinions and values and preferences in terms of their visibility and educating. There's a certain level of energy that goes into that, especially when it's when there isn't the language quite there yet. There is a different level of exhaustion that comes with that. So I want to know more about how you all have found your way to becoming where you're at now and what you,
We're kind of raised to always pretend like we're okay. And unfortunately, a lot of the time when you're not okay, you really want to reach out, but it's like we're socialized to think like that's weak. You need to be strong all the time. Having emotions is weak. That's not the case. I've talked a lot about my family. My mother is very, very supportive, and so is my father. He's a little bit more quiet, and he complains that I don't mention him a lot. And I'm like, well, you don't talk a lot, so... And, like, when I'm in documentaries and stuff, he's like, I don't want to be in front of the camera. They steal your soul. I'm like, okay, Dad. My parents are both very supportive, so I've definitely had a better experience than a lot of my peers, but it's the unfortunate truth that a lot of people don't get those good experiences, especially in rural and under-resourced communities and in Indigenous communities. A lot of the time, something that gets brought up is like, because my mental illnesses come from trauma, as well as a genetic factor, but mostly from trauma, the thing that has been brought up to me before is, do you think you're trans because you were assaulted? No. Just a hint, no. There's also an element of, do you think you're trans because you have a personality disorder? No. Just because I have a mental illness doesn't mean that it's directly related to being trans. And I've also had counselors who have insisted that all my issues are because I'm trans. I'm like very obsessive about having a clean toothbrush. I have to boil it, like in boiling hot water to use it. My old counselor insisted that it was because I didn't want to take care of myself because I hated myself so much for being trans, which I was like, no, that's not how it works, thank you. But yeah, that's kind of been my experience, and I kind of went a little off topic, but you know, I strive to stay there. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all. If we don't have any last comments here, I think we can start question and answers if there are any. Is that all okay with you? Yeah.
Very.
Yeah, we will finish up this panel discussion.
I just want to say thank you for sharing your own experiences, and I want to just comment, and one of the reasons why I'm here today is you may comment about, in many cases, the doctors don't know how to respond to you, they don't have information. I'm a nurse. I teach here at Ryerson in the nursing curriculum, and one of the reasons I'm here today is because I don't, as we undergo curriculum changes, I don't think we have enough information in our curriculums. As a nurse myself, I feel I don't know enough in order, and as a teacher, to be able to share it with others. And I think that's, I hope you guys continue to push that agenda for better education, not just for doctors, for nurses, for every educator, teacher, or an individual you may encounter, that in general the public still doesn't have enough information. And I'm hoping by being here today that I can gain some information that will help me move forward changes as we look at curriculum for nurses and how we address trans in our education system. So thank you.